Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast that spotlights some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities, which is not, as the name would lead you to believe, an association of black charities. Rather, it's a public foundation that focuses on addressing racial disparities in Baltimore and across Maryland, with an emphasis on economic equity and the workforce. Before Diane came to Associated Black Charities in 2007, she was a senior fellow at the Annie E. Casey Foundation and led the nonprofit that managed Baltimore's Empowerment Zone. Diane talked a little bit about our culture's misplaced emphasis on heroes and sheroes, and some of the challenges that come with working for a charity with black in the name. A Washington, D.C. native, Diane discussed the importance of building relationships in Baltimore, what it means to be a civic leader, and pushing back against the limitations people try to place on her. Here's our conversation. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities, but I'm also a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. And I would consider myself a civic leader here in Baltimore.
Where are you from originally?
Originally, I'm from Washington, D.C. I'm a fourth-generation Washingtonian that moved to Prince George's in my middle school years. But very much, I think, a Baltimorean at heart.
What was your childhood like in D.C.?
It was very interesting in terms of it was that time of kind of growing African-American middle class in D.C. and lots of opportunity in terms of to expand as my parents' income changed. And, of course, that's when we moved to the suburbs. In terms of that also was a different kind of opportunity, both in terms of relationship and education, but it moved to an all-African-American homeownership enclave in Prince George's County. Childhood was great. Set of friends and family and siblings that were all very close about being a family. And so it was a good childhood. Parents were separated and divorced, but very much supported in the environment in that neighborhood as well as the neighborhood we moved to in middle school.
And you said you were fourth generation in D.C.?
I'm a fourth generation Washingtonian.
Were you guys always in the same area of the city?
Yes, in terms of when I was living, when we lived in the city, we were. But this obviously goes back generations in terms of my father's father, and generation before that. And so I'm very proud of that, although it was only recently that I will publicly admit that, because there's a danger sometimes in Baltimore admitting that I'm not a Baltimorean.
Yes, the D.C.-Baltimore rift is definitely real. When you lived in D.C., did you like know what was going on in Baltimore? Did you have were you interested in Baltimore at all as a child?
I became interested in Baltimore as a teenager. I came to Baltimore as a teenager spending time in the summer. Wanda Draper, who used to be at WBAL, who is now the executive director of the Reginald Lewis Museum. We were friends as teenagers. Her godmother lived up the street from where I grew up now in the county, Prince George's County. And I began to visit Baltimore and visit with her. So I got a chance to visit a number of the landmarks at the time in terms of the famous ballroom as a teenager and a number of other things teenagers did in Baltimore. And so I fell in love with Baltimore. So I was always very intent that I was going to come here and live and go to work and go to school. And so I continued to visit Wanda during those years. And so Baltimore was my emotional home. I would definitely say that. So I was determined I was going to live in Baltimore.
Do you think part of that was, I don't know, the allure of something different than what all of your family had done before staying in D.C. and everything?
Baltimore always felt like a small town. Baltimore always felt like very much the environment that I grew up in. And I think that's what resonated me to Baltimore in terms of a sense of family, a sense of belonging, which is a little bit hard to do in D.C. And as D.C. has grown, I think that's harder to do, although there are certainly neighborhoods in D.C. where there's that sense of closeness, but it's not overall in terms of across the board in Washington, D.C. Even Baltimore, with all of its differences, there's still this sense of connection and family that I think is so much easier to get to than it is in Washington, D.C.
So how did you find the transition to be when you moved to Prince George's County?
Oh, I was young. I mean, it was an easy transition. I mean, it was about having our first home, moving from an apartment to a house, having my own bedroom, being able to have a different set of friends and activities and clubs. And so it was fun. It was lots of fun. Babysitting, that's where all kind of my first things at that level began to happen in Prince George's County.
When you were young, did you know what you wanted to be when you grew up?
No. When I was young, I wanted to be a nurse. I think my mother, who I would credit as being very influential in moving me in the direction of my gifts, my mother was very clear that I had an ability to connect to people. As I continued to grow and move in my educational cycle, my mother could sense my kind of natural affinity, natural ability to hear people, to respond back to people, to be helpful in that people environment. So my mother began to move me in a different direction, away from nursing to ultimately the field that I ended up getting my master's in, which is social work. And that experience was probably very much where I think my calling comes from, in the realm of people and achieving social change, which is not directly social work anymore. But I think that is where my mom began to move me in that direction, because of the gifts I demonstrated very young.
Were those gifts clear to you?
No. Those gifts probably didn't become as clear to me until I was actually in undergraduate school, and a supervisor also noticed the gifts and would talk about them. It probably still didn't become clear to me until I was well into my 20s and got very clear that I had some special talent, some special gifts, that I was able to discern people's energies, emotions, oftentimes before they spoke them. And I use that in my everyday living. I use that in my work role. I use it in my personal life. And I don't think I realized that until my early 20s that I was using those gifts to make a difference.
Was your mom a social worker?
She was not. My mom was a stay-at-mom for a number of years, but she worked at the post office. And then my mom, before she retired, and she has since deceased, but I'm very proud of my mother. She was the first African-American director of the White House Office of Mail Analysis. And that was very, very big deal for my mother, and that my mother only had a high school diploma and was able to use her gifts and talents and her ability to be with people, and just her drive for learning, her drive for always wanting to learn and grow, really propelled her. And I'm sure I inherited that drive from her and my father.
So were you a lover of learning when you were young?
I can remember that I was reading when I was 3-4 years old. I've always loved reading. I've always loved learning. My father was a big part of that as well, in terms of driving in neighborhoods or driving in different communities. I would be looking at houses wondering, so I wonder what's going on in that house. I wonder what the people are thinking in that house. And so my father said, you need to ask people when you want to know what they're thinking. Dinner table conversations were always pushing us to think, to be critical thinkers. So I've always had a thirst for learning.
And you went to the University of Maryland for undergraduate, right?
I went to two campuses for undergraduate, University of Maryland. I went to College Park for my first 2 years, which was near my home. And then it was clear that I wanted to transfer to Baltimore, and I went to UMBC because UMBC had an undergraduate program in social work.
Okay, so it was it a change of direction, a change of major then that brought you there, or you were just trying to go to Baltimore regardless?
No, it was a major as well as Baltimore, because I was still in contact with lots of people I knew in Baltimore. And a number of people who live in Baltimore went to College Park, including Wanda Draper. There was a kind of cohort of people that were from Baltimore that were at College Park that I still had relationships with. But I was also clear, beginning to look towards my major and realize that UMBC had a undergraduate degree in social work. I wasn't sure that I was going to do graduate school. So I wanted to try that, at least have that under my belt.
And what was your college experience like?
College Park was just too large. It was too large for me. It was not an environment that I remember enjoying very much. And one, because I commuted to school every day. I think that's a different college experience than ultimately when I moved to Baltimore and living on the campus of UMBC. But I will tell you, UMBC is great of experience as it was, because it fed my thirst for learning. It fed my thirst to be a critical thinker. It pushed hard. I could push back in my classrooms with my professors, the learning environment, the door. It was really important in that kind of environment to be able to push the edges around my thinking. But it was also new in terms of the campus. I was at UMBC when the dorms were named, dorms 1, 2, and 3. So that was the beginning. But it was also a challenging environment racially. The neighborhood in which UMBC lies at that time, lots of racial challenges in how African Americans were perceived in that community. So there were times that we were cautioned about leaving the campus in terms of health or and what experience we might have in leaving the campus. There were times on the campus, my first memory outside of the South, traveling as a teenager with my grandmother outside of the South, that was my first time being called the N-word. So it was a unique experience, but again, I gravitate towards environments that provide support, and it was a great supportive environment on campus. Particularly the African-American students that lived on campus really band together and became each other's family in that environment.
I mean, in what way, if at all, did that negative experience impact you? And was that a surprise to confront, like, in that kind of environment?
It was a surprise, but I'm a fighter. I've always been a fighter. I'm a fighter to this day, and that I don't accept anyone else's limitations on me. And so somebody says that, you must be crazy. That's your problem, not mine. And so I push back. We had lots of conversations on campus about what to do in those environments. We had lots of deep conversations in terms of organizing, in terms of our own space. We had lots of beliefs that young people have about changing the world. So it wasn't a bad experience. It was, I would tell you, it was an opportunity to grow my advocacy skills.
Have you encountered many other times in your life when people have tried to place those limitations on you?
All the time. All the time. I think some of that is based upon both for me as an African American. I think it's also me as a woman. I think it's also combined with me as a woman, African American, who's 5 feet. I think people look, as people can judge based upon looking, and believe, oh, she's easy, or, oh. And I'm always surprised people when I'm very aggressive, I'm very smart, I'm very articulate, and I push back, and I don't accept those limitations. But certainly, people, if you allow them, will place limitations. But I would say that I've also been very blessed in the ability to find mentors, black, white, men, women, but largely men have been strong mentors for me throughout my career. But I intentionally look for them. I intentionally reach out as I seek to grow, as I seek to expand my relationship, expand my horizon. I'm very intentional about that and looking around. Where am I going? Who can help me get there? And how do I learn more so that I'm more prepared when I get there?
So when you were a young social work major, what direction did you see your life taking, or what would have been like a great career for you at that time?
I don't know that I saw a horizon other than being in management and leading an organization as a social worker. I was in clinical, but I only stayed in clinical post-graduation for a very brief period of time. I've always propelled and always moved up in systems. Whatever job I've ever had, I've always moved up in that organization from one position progressively to the next, many times until I'm a leader. So that's really just who I am. And so I'm not sure that I had a endpoint in my mind in terms of social work, as much as I knew early on after graduate school that I was not going to stay in clinical social work. I was taught from a systems change perspective in social work. A professor I will always remember, who has since deceased, really pushed hard around us having a framework of achieving change through understanding how systems are a part of the barriers for achieving change. So I'm really consider myself a systems analysis, and I believe change comes, deeper change, sustainable change, comes from changing systems.
So you came to Associated Black Charities in 2007. Can you tell me about what you do and about what Associated Black Charities is?
Yes, I can tell you that Associated Black Charities is not an association of charities. Many people, it's a misnomer from the name. I'll go back and tell you where that name comes from. But Associated Black Charities is a public foundation very focused on economic equity, understanding that a barrier for economic equity is structural racism. But our change lever is workforce and the workforce ecosystem, both directly the worker, but also the environment, which is the employer, and all of those support systems that move that direction. We know from a data standpoint that the economic disparities that we face in this country, in this city, are directly related both to the lack of robust African-American businesses that have employees and therefore will hire African-Americans, which is a documented research over and over again, to workers not being able to stay attached to work So we also, early on in the career of ABC, of my being there, actually had dollars and grants we made for persons to go into employment sectoral training, as well as direct kind of linkage to employers. But we learned that as you do that, that sometimes workers weren't staying attached to work, that they didn't have the kind of behavioral competencies. They didn't have the networks. They didn't have the knowledge to be successful in that environment, which led us to be very clear where we are now. We're kind of part of the continuum that I believe exists in Baltimore of folks in the space of helping people move to employment. But we're clear that's around helping the worker stay attached and go up that career ladder, because we also need them to be clear about what those additional growth can provide in terms of assets, home ownership, even just in deciding to do their own business, becoming much more a part of the fabric of the economic contribution in this city.
Does the work focus on Baltimore, or is it all across Maryland?
The work is leaning more and more now towards just Baltimore, although we do have an office in Eastern Shore where it's much more focused on health disparities. It's very successful in terms of they have a phenomenal relationship with the health department there, and they're the outreach workers because they have a relationship with the community organizations where they're very respected, and they're able to connect with residents on the ground to help connect them to the education, to the change in their knowledge and behavior to change health outcomes. We also have a relationship in Prince George's County where we are the state's EARN, which is a grant based upon focusing on sector employment through the employer's eyes. We're the EARN intermediary for work around healthcare in Prince George's County. But I think we're moving more and more towards being very focused on Baltimore.
And why is that?
Recognizing that you can't be all things to all people, that if we want to be able to be very impactful in this space, we don't have a lot of money. Lots of different ways we raise money, and we are, again, a public charity, but a big part of our fundraising, big part of our resources is donations from individuals. But then we really have to be much more impactful. We have to demonstrate that not only our theories are real, but demonstrate that in practicing those theories that we can produce a different set of economic outcomes for Baltimore. The goal of that is, as we develop volunteer career mentors who we partner with employees as they go to work, demonstrating that can change wages over time. As we develop African-American Latinos to sit on nonprofit boards, demonstrating that that can make a difference for that organization. So we've taken the stance that although we may be small in our resources, we can be impactful if we're very focused on how we use those resources and demonstrate that something different, including the training that we do for public policy space around for legislators, the training we do for organizations, helping them understand how their policies can have structural racialized barriers built in, unbeknown to them. It's not intentional. It's a part of the structuralized challenge that lies inside of the fabric of our communities, the fabric of America.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say demonstrate and prove, because you obviously do have all of this data. Does a lot of energy have to go into convincing people that it's proven and that it's real?
Absolutely. We are still in a great deal of denial, I believe, in this country around the disconnect that happens based upon structural racialized barriers. It is not about, again, intentionality sometimes. Sometimes it is. But it's really around when you develop a set of policies. We develop policies in this country, whether they're public, private, through a set of universal lens. We believe as we design a policy that what we design is good for everybody. We don't take in consideration lives are different based upon race. We don't take that into consideration. And when you don't, you get often differential negative outcomes. I tell people, often use this phrase to explain, if you looked at the disparities by race, whether you look at it by income, look at it by health, look at it by education, look at it by business, look at it by any standard you want to use, you'd have to begin to ask, are African Americans as a people stupid, or is there something structural going on? Well, I'm clear African Americans are not stupid. I'm clear the Latinos are not stupid. I'm clear that we have some racialized barriers that are in place that when we're able to remove them economically, as a collective, as a city, we benefit all. If you understand that, I believe it's a recent article in terms of Center for American Progress. If African-American workers earned at the same level as white workers, we would have an increase of $1 trillion. That's an economic equation. And that's what we're trying to help people understand. Social justice is important, and that's an important framework. But our framework is economic equity, because in achieving that and removing those barriers, we all benefit in terms of the bottom line. And so that's why we're in this space in terms of pushing that conversation. It's a win-win. It's a challenge, because race is a challenge for us as a country. It's a challenge in terms of moving that direction. But I've seen progress in Baltimore, certainly after last year. I think business leaders, civic leaders, I think we're all more hypersensitive, trying to grapple with this, trying to understand. Traditionally, though, I think people tend to pay attention to it from a transactional standpoint. Transactions alone are important, but they're not enough.
I wonder if you experience a lot of people who get defensive or bristle at any of the work you're trying to do, because it seems like to me, anecdotally, around the election and everything, people would try to talk about racial inequity and economic factors. And it seems some people take that to personally mean, like, I'm racist, I don't like black people, which is, of course, not always the case. Mm-hmm. But is it difficult to kind of show people these structural barriers?
It can be difficult. But what we understand is that this is a learning process. It's not a one-time event. That you have to help people grow to understand the factual nature of the information. You have to make people comfortable to have the conversation. That doesn't happen overnight. And you want to find people that are more open than others to having the conversation. And when you find that, you can use that to also bring in their colleagues, because they become a part of bringing their colleagues in. We have a partnership with Baltimore Community Foundation and the Aspen Institute. It's called the Baltimore Aspen Partnership. There are 40 civic corporate leaders over the last 5 years that have come together, have gone through training on structural racism that increased their knowledge of what it is and isn't. And it's not a program. It really is a convening of like-minded persons so that we can change our skills and our ability to change where we sit as corporate civic leaders. It's been a very good movement in my mind of bringing people about that change, having them hear this conversation differently. This year, we're moving to be even more intentionally to expand the scope, to bring in even other civic corporate leaders into that conversation. We think that's an important part of changing the long-term economic outcome for this city, for this region. And it's important to also begin to demonstrate, as I said, transactionally, that African-American workers can achieve more and can be assets. But we know that that's not on the individual alone. It's how do we impact those environments? And that's why it's important to bring the business community into the conversation.
What are some strategies you use to try to have those productive conversations when they can be uncomfortable?
Well, my team and I spend a lot of time, a lot of relationship building. You can't have any of these conversations. You can't even begin to have the conversation unless you have a relationship. So I probably spend an inordinate amount of time just building relationships in town, sitting on boards, probably too many.
Yeah, you sit on a lot of boards. I was going to ask you about that.
It's intentional. Some of it I will begin to pull back on, but it's been intentional. I want people to be comfortable with who I am. I want people to be comfortable with the organization. I want people to know that I am sincere, that this is really about our collective benefit, that I'm not grinding an axe just to grind an axe, that I really want to know more about what they care about, so that we move towards all of this together. And that makes it a slower process, because you really do have to build trust. One of the things I can tell you from my experience with the years I led the Empowerment Zone, which I'm glad to say was one of the most successful in the country in terms of its basic outcomes, the success of that was dependent upon both the grassroots community, corporate leadership, beginning to develop trust, to have a set of rules of engagement that allowed them to come together and grow to understand they really wanted the same thing. It is the disconnect, is our belief that we have separate desires that doesn't allow trust to happen. So the intentionality is to grow trust, uses the relationships to grow trust, to demonstrate with the data, to demonstrate with actual leaders that are already in that space, to use national data, local data, to use every opportunity to help grow people's knowledge of what this is about versus what it is not about. And so that's how we are moving this agenda forward, including training that we will do for organizations. There's an organization that I currently serve as a chair of, recently became the chair, but 5 years ago began a journey with Humanum, a major workforce organization here in the state. It has 400 plus employees, one of the most phenomenal organizations around social enterprises. But they didn't recognize that they had challenges around structural racism. And over a period of time, because of their leadership, Henry Pascoe's the CEO, this is a 5-year journey. They really wanted to understand how they could be better at the outcome of helping African-American workers get connected. It is that journey that led them to ultimately training for the board, for the staff, but ultimately led to them agreeing to having us in partnership with Casey pay for a racial equity assessment that was conducted by an external consultant that helped them understand where their policies and practices had some racialized barriers. Not intentionally at all. And unearthing that, they began to shift, began to change some of their policies, create a different culture in the organization. They're doing phenomenal in terms of that. And it's a journey. It's not over. But it's their leadership and the board leadership that began to understand, wow, this is limiting us. And this is not good to limit what we say we're in the business about doing. We did that with other organizations. This is probably one of the more successful. We will continue to offer that as we move forward with other organizations, both for-profit, not-for-profit. But again, it's a slower pathway to help people to say, I need to look inside, or I need you to look inside of your organization and discover where some challenges exist and be ready and know that we're going to support you as you look inside and we're going to support you as you go forward. And so people have to be comfortable that that's going to happen and they're not going to be held in a way of saying, I got you. This is not about I got you. This is about changing the economic outcome for all of us.
What does it mean to you to be a civic leader? And when did you feel you became one?
I'm not quite sure when that happened. I would tell you that my husband says it happens too much because I'm out too much. And I would also tell you my husband says I do too much, and he's probably right. I think it was just a natural, I think it's a part of all of our responsibility in this city. If you care about this city, if you work here, if you live here, you need to be invested. You need to be invested in it. That we cannot move to being a different city and the greatness that I know that we can be unless we are engaged and bring about that greatness. Some of us do it differently, but I think it's important to be engaged and bring about that difference. I think it was just always who I am in terms of I've never been able to stay in my lane, rather whatever that is in terms of a job, and see that as just my lane. My vision on the world is always a larger vision. My seeking solutions, and I'm a good problem solver, is always broad because it's always towards a set of outcomes. I'm not about programs. I'm very much about outcomes and about pushing things forward so we can achieve outcomes and helping us see what we don't see so that we can achieve a different set of outcomes. I've always been in that kind of space. That's an important space for me. Then saying, oh, I'm just real excited about a program. What I know about programs is you can get stuck and not see some of the evolving things that are happening in environments or even some of the structural things that prevent us from moving towards our greatness.
When you took this job, what did you feel least prepared for?
I felt least prepared for some of the challenges that were inside of the organization historically that the organization had that I think happens to organizations of color sometimes because they don't have the resources necessary by virtue of being in the world we live in terms of where resources go, don't often necessarily go to African-American organizations. So we had a budget challenge when I got there. Some of those challenges shift and move over time. I'm not sure I was prepared for that because I didn't know about it till I got there. Continue to grow and develop capacity of the organization. But I think also what I was not prepared for was how people view an Associated Black Charities, and that even the word having black in the name can be disconcerting for some people. I think that's just true in terms of America. And so I was not prepared for that. I don't think I realized that that would be a part of it, that I would have to push so much so my own personal brand, my own personal agenda, personal relationships that people grew and grow and knew me, trusted to help them understand this wasn't about undoing something or attacking people. This is about making a difference in this city that we could all be a part of.
In what ways did that manifest? Was it people just unwilling to work with Associated Black Charities, or in what ways did people not respond well to having black in the name like that?
I think it plays out in how we're funded in terms of what you might see a funder would provide for a white-led organization versus an organization that has black in its name or an organization that's focus on transformative change versus just transactional. I think that's true for many people, black and white, in the sense of it's easier to focus on organizations who you think are doing good and really kind of the song of creating heroes, sheroes, changing people's lives around, really moving the needle and moving more people to work. All those are great things to do, but what I know, not just from research, I know factually from the work of the Empowerment Zone of $100 million, that transactional is not enough. I think it's about beginning to change people's lens and knowledge of what really can change outcomes, a much more transformative efforts of going deep on the systemic barriers if you want something to be sustainable. But our country lives on this role of creating sheroes and heroes. Our country lives on this frame of you can do it and we can all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And that's a myth. It's a myth for white America. Because when you look at where wealth lies in our country, what percentage of wealth is owned by a small percentage versus where the rest of the country lies. But we don't have those conversations. Unfortunately, media creates a space of selling heroes and sheroes, and this is the way to go. And that's not factual. It's important, but it's not the complete truth. I think that makes it hard in terms of resources. I think, fair to ABC historically, I think it was also the organization had to shift and had to people see it more relevant. I would say that challenge of even how people see us is limited by marketing. We don't have a marketing budget. I'm not going to have a marketing budget. How do I get the word out about how do we help translate, which is hard concepts, into marketable concepts that people can understand and gravitate towards? So it's an ongoing challenge that we push forward in terms of as we seek funding, as we seek donors, as we do fundraisers. It becomes critical finding continuously ways of articulating that message that people can get clear what we're doing is transactional, has some outcome over tomorrow, but the larger goal of our work is outcomes over time. The arch of change is a longer arch. And we tend to fund and believe change occurs in bite-sized increments of 2 days. And that's not real.
And having heroes and sheroes is a lot sexier and flashier and easier to pay attention to, right?
Absolutely. So you've got to find the balance. How do you help people see these sheroes and heroes? And I would tell you, I would love anybody out listening about marketing in terms of how do you help people see sheroes and heroes, and even in the long arch kind of work that has to be accomplished for us to obtain sustainable change. And sustainable change is important. And understanding, particularly for this city, as any city, where you have a predominant number of people who are African-American, that African-Americans are not broken in terms of understand that their systems, policies that have broken, that created lots of what we see, but we continue to try to see how we can fix people.
I'm curious how your work has changed after the arrest and death of Freddie Gray, and if any additional time or resources have had to go into any kind of rebranding of Baltimore, because that certainly changed some outsiders' perceptions of the city.
I think we became much more intentional, much louder about our work. We have always talked about structural racism. We've always had the research. We began with a much larger agenda 11 years ago called More in the Middle, understanding that Baltimore could have a greater African-American middle class if it paid attention to issues of the disparities in home ownership and what did that look like if you were going to change that for African-Americans. If you paid attention to the difference in African-American business with employees, if you could make a difference there. If you made a difference in terms of African Americans being connected to work, if you made a difference in terms of financial literacy, we actually had Anibon Basu, Sage Policy, do an economic analysis of what would that difference be for Baltimore if it were successful. It could be $33 billion difference. But that's a huge agenda. And as one of my board members said at the time, we certainly couldn't boil the ocean. So over time, we migrated and we continued to do the research, and as well as higher education is one of those levers. And we got clear that we had to begin to focus on one area, but we also had to be clear that just focusing on that area transactionally, as well as grants we would make, was not enough, that the structural challenges were still there. So having obtained that focus even before the Freddie case, we were talking about this issue. We were talking about structural racism. We had done the relationship with Humanum, do the racial equity assessment. We were partnering with Aspen Institute. We began to move in that direction. So we were clear there was this transactional agenda and a transformative agenda. We weren't as vocal about the transformative agenda because of the transactional was where funders, where people were more likely to fund us, gravitate. But we began to be clear as we were sitting at tables across the region to the Opportunity Collaborative, other tables. We talked more and more about structural racism, trying to help people get comfortable with those words, that it wasn't personalized, that it was about systems. And so we get pushback. People would say to us, don't have that conversation. Don't say that out loud. People are going to look at you strange. Don't talk about that. I would say after Freddie Gray, people said, please talk about it. You were right. We were wrong. It didn't change the funding because, as still, the challenge of being an African-American organization, people are likely not to view us at the same level as they might view a larger foundation, a larger community foundation, which I absolutely love. I'm a trustee there. But we're viewed differently in terms of when that happened. And so the money didn't flow to us, although we probably had the most on-ground relationship already in place. That's just the reality of America that I'm very clear about. So we became even more active in reaching out to community-based organizations. We became more active of convening some of the social justice advocates, many who we had relationships with. How do we connect them to other relationships? Part of our asset is our ability to be at all the different tables and have credibility at different tables, but to recognize we're not the it, that sometimes our added value is how do we connect lots of our community that's unconnected right now to others. And that's where we continue to double down on.
What do you think people get wrong about the work that you do or about Associated Black Charities?
Obviously, our name presents a challenge for people in believing that we are like Associated Catholic Charities or Associated Jewish Charities, that we're an association of charities. We are not. That was the intention at the founding of the organization, but we're not that. So they get that wrong. I think many people would tell you up until my having this conversation right now, they didn't know what we did. People would say, oh, we really like them. We really respect them. What do they do now? I think we've gotten very clear. With the blessing and the support, financial support of Annie E. Casey Foundation, we've been going through a strategic planning process with our board leadership and our staff leadership. And this is where we've gotten very, very clear about who we are. And we can say to people, we are about economic equity. We understand how it's impacted by structural racism. And our change lovers workforce and the workforce ecosystem. And that's where we will drill down on to make that difference.
What's the greatest frustration you encounter in your job? And what continues to motivate you to push through that?
The greatest frustration for me, which keeps me awake every month more than others, is always going to be funding. I think it's a mistake that the for-profit community makes and not understanding that not-for-profits struggle with similar issues in terms of payroll, that people tend to, it's how we view the nonprofit world without viewing the reality. So fundraising, development, are always things that keep me awake in terms of both doing the work and doing the work as part of my salary, doing the work as part of my staff salary, doing the work is moving that agenda forward, as well as the touching in terms of the volunteer career mentors, touching in terms of behavioral competency, touching in terms of the board pipeline. All that's the work, but it's all encompassing the work. That's what probably is the most challenge for me, is how to help people understand that framework. And this year, we also, having been pushed by my board in a real positive way, we will begin to explore social enterprise. We will begin to understand that we need to be more focused on how we can create profit, in the sense of how can we use what is already our assets and actually bring in a different set of revenue. I'm excited about that change for us because it moves you from being a passive organization to understanding that you actually are part of both your strategy and supporting your strategy and proving that others support it by finding ways to create profit off of what you do.
Are you optimistic about Baltimore's future? And is it ever difficult to be optimistic?
Oh my God. Yes and no. By nature, I'm an optimist. I can't stay in this space unless I was an optimist. The challenge are vast, the pushbacks are vast, but also the rewards are vast. when you begin to see shifts like Humanum, when you begin to see shifts in terms of Laura Gamble from PNC as a part of our Aspen partnership, and she gets it, she understands it. Those are really, you know, that's going to lead to ultimately some different kind of outcomes for us over time. The challenge is being in the space at the moment. The challenge is being in the space, particularly as an African-American woman, where I may share my reality in a particular conversation or a particular environment, particularly in the funders world, the foundation world. And people will look at me like, I don't understand what you're saying. They don't know my reality. And I think the worst part of the space is not just not knowing my reality. I'm okay with that. But the part of the problem is people that look and hear my reality from me or even others that look like me and want to deny that reality because it's not their reality. It's the only thing I think is the most challenging for me because it's painful, it's hurtful. I would say the analogy would be having any kind of challenge unrelated to race and having a person tell you that that challenge, oh, that's not real. You don't have that. You can be different. I would ask people to think about that as they think about having conversations with people of color, Black, Latino, and someone shares with you their world and shares with you the reality of their world, including the police stopping you or the fear of police stopping you just because you're Black. That's not an experience someone white's going to have, but that's reality. That because you don't have it doesn't make it true or doesn't make it not true. I think that's my greatest frustration is how to help people understand that reality. And also my frustration, I think, is how do we even grow closer, more intentional as a people of color in this town? How do I help African-American businesses understand that it's to their benefit as well to support us, that we really are pushing their agenda as well? We know the value they had. But sometimes people arrive at individual successes and they believe, well, I did it. Why can't you? Oh, I did it. Why can't others? That's a fantasy. That's a fantasy we keep selling in this country. It doesn't allow us to get down to the hard systemic problems that are challenging us. So those are things that frustrate me. Those are things that particular bad day I may say, okay, I'm quitting. I'm done. I'm through. I can't take this anymore. It may last for a day. I tend to come back the next day and go, okay, what's the solution? How do we do this? How do we overcome this? How do we move this? Because I am an optimist, because I believe with every fiber of my being, I believe deep in my spiritual self, I believe as I have in my entire life, that we can only be successful when we understand the assets that people of color bring to this city, to this country, and that those are assets, they're not liabilities. And I've seen when this happens, what difference can be made, and it has to be made on a much larger scale. It is that belief. It is using my gifts of seeing the unseen that I recognize that keeps me at the table.
Diane, thanks so much for speaking today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Diane Bell McCoy. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. You can also find us at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble or on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.